up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Sounds from one of the many immigration protests being held around the U.S. A coalition of left-leaning activists, including groups that organized the massive women's marches the past 2 years, are helping to coordinate more than 600 demonstrations across the country that they hope could draw hundreds of thousands of people who oppose the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy on immigration. Saturday's rallies, which are being called Families Belong Together, are getting funding and support from several large organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union and MoveOn.org. The Trump administration says that a judge's ruling requiring the government to reunite migrant children and their families who were separated at the U.S. border could result in the children being detained longer than currently allowed. The government will not separate families but detain families together during the pendency of immigration proceedings when they are apprehended at or between ports of entry, according to the Justice Department court filing. Families could be expected to be detained for months or even years due to thousands of immigration cases already backlogged in the court system. A federal court settlement known as the Flores Agreement does not allow detained minors to be held for more than 20 days. A U.S. District Court judge ruled Tuesday in San Diego, California, that separated families had to be reunited within 30 days and children under 5 returned in 2 weeks. Officials now say about 2,000 children are waiting to be reunited with their families. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. President Trump is not signaling for an immediate plan to withdraw the United States from the World Trade Organization. When asked about it, he did say the U.S. has been treated very badly by the WTO. And then when asked his plans for withdrawing from it, he said not at this point, but they have to treat us fairly. Meanwhile, on the issue of trade tariffs, the U.S. Commerce Department asked for public comments before holding public hearings on possibly placing tariffs on imported vehicles.
Concerns about new tariffs come in response to President Trump's call for a Commerce Department investigation into whether auto imports pose enough of a threat to U.S. national security to justify new tariffs. The president used that section of the Trade Expansion Act of 1962 to slap tariffs on imported steel and aluminum, which led to retaliatory taxes from the European Union, Mexico, Canada, Turkey, and India.
That's AP's Jackie Quinn reporting. Afghanistan's president says the government's unilateral ceasefire with the Taliban has come to an end. Ashraf Ghani said Saturday the ceasefire is over. The Afghan security and defense forces are allowed to restart their military operations. The insurgents have killed scores of Afghan personnel in attacks across the country since ending their temporary ceasefire during a 3-day annual Muslim festival. The unprecedented suspension of insurgent hostilities had come in response to a week-long Afghan government ceasefire that was later extended for 10 days that ended on Saturday. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayed Raad Al Hussein warned of a humanitarian catastrophe in the southwestern Syrian city of Dara, if the fighting continues to escalate between Russian-backed Syrian forces and armed rebels. The UN said thousands of people are fleeing the fighting, but warned civilians caught in the violence are likely to be trapped in the government because Jordan has closed its border, guarding off their main escape route. Militants armed with guns and explosives attacked the headquarters of an African military task force in central Mali, killing 2 soldiers there and 1 civilian. The attackers detonated a car bomb packed with explosives, destroying the entrance to the G5 Sahel headquarters Friday, and then entered the compound firing guns. Nearly a week has gone by since a group of boys and their soccer coach, who had gone exploring in a sprawling cave complex in northern Thailand, were last heard from. But the families received words of encouragement from the country's prime minister. The prime minister visited the boys' families, who have been staying near the cave complex during the rescue attempt. The cave complex runs about 10 kilometers under a mountain in the province. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Netline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga. Peter Clote has the day off.
I call on Eritrea to put an immediate stop to the indefinite national service and to arbitrary arrest and detention.
A persistent pattern of human rights violations in Eritrea severely restricts the fundamental freedoms of its citizens.
I couldn't understand why the chairperson of the coalition should be removed as vice president and be replaced by Hussein Oudam. I thought we are all part of the coalition, and that coalition spirit and unity should survive until the end of the transitional government.
Gambian President Adama Barrow reshuffles his government, moving the leader of his ruling party from the foreign ministry to the position of vice president.
I could deploy bulk SMSs to tell neighboring communities to shut down their roads when we were protesting so that police couldn't reach us. It was just this one device that enabled a much bigger world.
And we take a look at the role of mobile phones and social media in the advancement of human rights in South Africa. Those stories and more coming up right here on Netline Africa. A UN investigator finds the persistent pattern of human rights violations in Eritrea severely restricts the fundamental freedoms of its citizens through punishments that often have fatal consequences. Lisa Schrein reports for VOA from Geneva, where Sheila Katheruha has presented her final report as special rapporteur on the human rights situation in Eritrea to the UN Human Rights Council.
Sheila Kitarut says there have been no improvements in Eritrea's human rights situation since she began her mandate as special rapporteur 6 years ago. The main violations she identified then, she says, persist to this day. These include arbitrary arrest and incommunicado detention, indefinite military or national service amounting to forced labor. She describes a host of other abusive practices that deprive people of their fundamental rights of freedom of expression and assembly.
I call on Eritrea to put an immediate stop to the indefinite national service and to arbitrary arrest and detention. It should immediately release all those arbitrarily detained, especially children, women, the elderly, and prisoners of conscience.
Eritrea's system of indefinite national service often lasts for decades. The conscripts include boys and girls as young as 16, as well as the elderly, who are used as forced labor. Forced military conscription is the main reason why young Eritreans flee to other countries seeking asylum. Keterut is particularly critical of the country's harsh prison conditions. She says prisoners are kept in overcrowded cells where food is inadequate and bad. She says access to fresh air and natural light is limited, and poor nutrition and lack of health care often leads to death in custody.
The Eritrean authorities intentionally use conditions and regime of detention as a means of torture or in support of other methods to increase the pain and suffering of inmates to achieve specific objectives.
Eritrean chargé d'affaires, Bereket Wolde Johannes, poured scorn upon the special rapporteur's report, saying it was destructive, lacking in objectivity and impartiality. He appealed to the council to bring to an end what he called this unfair and counterproductive process and experience. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Across in West Africa, Gambia's President Adama Barrow has fired his vice president, Fatuma Jallow Tambajag, and a host of cabinet ministers. He made the major cabinet reshuffle on Friday, and for VOA, Pandiere Mbai reports.
weekend cabinet reshuffle came as a surprise to the nation, including President Barrow's own fired ministers. One of them is the former Agriculture Minister, Omar Amadi Jallow.
I've never anticipated it. I've never seen it coming. I always tell people that I have 1.5 years more to go, because for me, as usual, I've told people that after the 3 years I'm going, because that's what the contract with the Gambian people that I have with the Gambian people.
Mr. Jallow's firing came in the wake of media reports alleging that he was involved in the sale of an expired fertilizer, a charge he vehemently denied. Mr. Jallow told VOA that his sacking has nothing to do with the fertilizer case.
He has fired, not me alone. He has removed health, they have minimal information, and he has removed the vice president. And this will have nothing to do with the fertilizer. I think he has just wanted to do a reshuffle, and then I think this is the way he thought he should do it.
President Adama Barrow came to power in December of 2016 after defeating Gambia's longtime dictator Yahya Jammeh. Mr. Barrow is due to leave Banjul on Saturday for Mauritania to attend the 34th ordinary session of the African Heads of State of the African Union. He has been accused of departing from the coalition government set agenda and goals.
From my own observation as a Gambian, I think there is a shift in position from the president to forget that he has been put in place by a coalition government and not by a party. And I think, for me, I think the only thing that Gambia had and God have made us happen was when 7 parties and 3 independents came together to form a coalition, and that was the reason why we ousted Yahya Jammeh.
President Barrow's cabinet reshuffle has been viewed by some political analysts as an attempt to consolidate himself in power. Analysts believe that Barrow is preparing for his second term in office at the end of the transition period. The coalition government has agreed for a 3-year transition period prior to ascending to power, but the constitution has given Mr. Barrow a 5-year mandate to stay in office. His term expires in 2021.
I couldn't understand why the chairperson of the coalition should be removed as vice president and be replaced by Hussein Oudam. I thought we are all part of the coalition, and that coalition spirit and unity should survive until the end of the transitional government. If not, we have betrayed the trust and confidence in the Gambian people, and we have betrayed the trust that God has put in the coalition.
Mr. Jallow has credited the former vice president Fatoumata Jallow Tambajang for being the main brain behind the opposition merger, which defeated Jammeh from power.
To be honest, I think the vice president was doing well, very well. And as he was the chairperson of the coalition, I think that position belongs to her. Because thank God she was the one through thick and thin who was coordinating and chairing and calling all the meetings. And with patience and perseverance of all the struggle and all the hustling within the committee, the executive, that's why we arrive where we arrive.
Barrow is a former member of the United Democratic Party, whose leader is the newly appointed vice president, Hussein Oudabo. Mr. Oudabo was foreign minister prior to his appointment as vice president. Barrow has resigned from the UDP to lead a group of opposition parties which formed a merger to defeat dictator Jammeh in the past elections. Jallow says even though he has been fired from the coalition government, he will not watch by and allow the government to depart from the coalition agenda. He says the government should stick to the democratic reform agenda they promised to the Gambian people.
For me, I will continue being an active politician because I owe it to this country. That's why I am here. And I will never, ever allow myself to be a standby, to stand by and see this Gambia move in the wrong direction and for me to keep quiet about. That's not possible.
For now, opinions are divided over Barrow's cabinet reshuffle. Some believe that it is a welcome development as far as shaping the affairs of the nation is concerned, while others have accused Barrow of sparing his former UDP colleagues in cabinet by not firing them. For VOA Africa, this is Panderimbay reporting.
A technical firm that is introducing low-income earners in Africa to affordable and easy-to-use solar power is among this year's winners of the Global Ashden Awards. They recognize and reward pioneers in sustainable energy. From Nairobi, reporter Robin Chama has more on Anganza, whose pay-as-you-go technology is used to make clean energy products affordable for those not connected to the national power grids.
Angaza, which has distributors through sub-Saharan Africa, won the Financial and Business Model Innovation Award for its solutions. The firm, which has offices in Nairobi, Kenya and San Francisco, California, creates solutions that allow clean energy products such as solar lanterns and charging points that can be remotely controlled, including being switched on and switched off, so they can run on a pay-as-you-go basis. Jane Kimani, Director of East Africa Operations at Angaza, received the award on behalf of the energy tech company.
We are very excited about that recognition. It validates our work. It says that we are doing the right thing. We thank the Ashton community for bringing us into the stable to join other companies that are innovating. Besides prize money, I think for us, we see an opportunity to really network with others who are like-minded. We have many billions of people, 1.2 billion to be precise, who are off-grid and who are continuing to suffer. And so we are all aligned in the same vision in terms of trying to remove the barriers that exist.
Sarah Butler-Slows is the founder director of Ashden. She commended the winners, saying that each was helping in different ways to transition to a low-carbon world that brings huge environmental, health, and economic benefits. But there are challenges to overcome, especially among small businesses. Kimani says one major drawback facing smaller companies is how to raise enough capital in return for small upfront payments from customers. This, she says, makes it difficult for local distributors to expand their businesses to reach more underserved communities.
The biggest challenge is that limitation of working capital for them to be able to scale up their businesses. In terms of products, products exist. The barrier really is in this ability to pay. So on the customer side, a lot of poverty has made it impossible for families to access these high-quality products. And so what happens is people are using products that are carbon-emitting and causing them health risks, death.
The senior official from the Kenya-based tech firm says African countries can learn some lessons from India and provide tax incentives for imported solar panels.
If you look at India as a market, there's a lot of government incentive. Families, you know, co-pay for some of these products with the support of government. So I think on the policy side, definitely, there can be a better collaboration between private sector and public, driving the agenda of clean energy and inclusiveness. In terms of tax breaks, I think we can do a better job, particularly if I look at Kenya, there's still a lot of tax that's imposed on importing some of these products.
The Hashnen Awards are a globally recognized measure of excellence in the field of sustainable energy, and winners receive tailored support to help scale up their work and a prize of up to 20,000 British pounds or around $26,000. Angaza was among 10 winners drawn from around the world for providing benefits to societies most at risk from the impact of climate change. Some 1.2 billion people around the world have no access to a power grid, according to the International Energy Agency. Ruben Chama reporting for VOA News in Nairobi.
A competition that could lead into new investments in startups has kicked off its African tour. It's called Seed Stars, and the campaign began last night in Harare, Zimbabwe. Judges had a tough time deciding which startup was going to represent the country at the Global Summit later this year in Switzerland. The winner will win $500,000 to inject into their startup and scale up. For VOA, Kuzai's Vinavashi has more details.
Mariam Gonja is the Seed Stars Associate for East Africa. She explains its work across the globe.
We are an investment company. Most of the people know us from one of our products, which is Sisters World Competition. We are present in about 88 emerging markets. What we do basically is invest in the best startups.
Judging from last night, Zimbabwe has no shortage of the best startups. Tadzoka Pswarai is the local Seed Stars ambassador and co-founder of Impact Hub, a local hub for entrepreneurs, startups, and artists where the Seed Stars pitch event was being hosted.
It was lovely. The jury always seems to have a hard time at these events. This year it was a difficult decision as well. That's also beautiful, because if you just had one business that was a front runner, you wouldn't have a difficult decision. There are so many entrepreneurs to think about. So then that's why it's difficult, because there's so much talent. That really makes all of the work, everything worth it.
Six Stars Harare 2018 winner is Rera.
As difficult as it was, a startup called Rera emerged as the champion set to represent Zimbabwe at the Global Summit. Rera is an online platform that funds small-scale farmers in their effort to raise poultry. Ratanang Nuku is with the team that won and was short for words.
I am excited. I still can't believe it. It's still sinking in. It's been a journey. It's been a lot of work. I'm so glad we made it up to this level.
Mkonja explains some of the key things that judges were looking for.
So judges were looking at traction, they were looking at uniqueness of ideas, they were looking if they were actually solving an actual problem in the markets that they identified. We're also looking at startups that haven't raised more than 500,000 in investment.
Entrepreneurship in Zimbabwe can be a lonely and difficult path. Some of the challenges encountered include a lack of access to funding from the traditional banking sector, plus an economic crisis and cash crisis. All of those have had a big impact on startups. Mkonja adds that it was a difficult decision, though one had to be made to move on. In her final words, she urged other investors to look into investing in the overwhelming talent in Harare. For VOA, this is Kudzai Nawashe from Harare.
A new study on a popular HIV drug potentially eases concerns about its link to depression. Once feared to cause depression and suicide, researchers in Uganda found efavirenz did not cause the expected negative side effects in their patients. For VOA, Sadie Witskonski reports.
Efavirenz is an affordable, once-a-day pill used around the globe to treat and prevent HIV/AIDS. It is one of the most common treatments, especially in countries that depend on global assistance to treat HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Some, however, fear that efavirenz may have a dark side. Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases tells the story of this early research conducted in the United States and Europe.
When the clinical trials groups that have been treating people with a variety of regimens of antiretroviral drugs looked at cohort data in a retrospective way, it looked like there was, in fact, an increased incidence of both depression and suicide in individuals who were receiving efavirenz.
Other studies did not find the depressive side effects, and the mixed results prompted many doctors in the United States to prescribe more expensive but potentially safer drugs. Mark Seidner of the African Health Research Institute wanted to take another look at the risk of depression, this time in an African population. He and a team of Ugandan and U.S. doctors tracked almost 700 patients from 2005 until 2015. They monitored patients who took efavirenz or another antiretroviral medication and asked the recipients whether they felt depressed or suicidal. Their analysis showed no difference between the treatments.
In other words, efavirenz was not associated with risk of depression. If anything, there seemed to be a signal that potentially it was associated with a decreased risk, but it wasn't a strong enough statement for us to say that.
Seidner also reported that of the 17 participants who died over the course of the study, not a single death was a suicide. He has two possible explanations for why their findings differ from those in Western countries.
One potential cause is that every single ethnic group in the world, of course, is different, and different in many, many different ways. They're different socially, they're different environmentally. In this case, they may be different genetically.
His team is currently looking at whether the genes that control metabolism of the drug have a role to play in this story. A second explanation could be the effectiveness of the drug. Because efavirenz is so potent, it could be keeping people healthier than they expected, so patients are less likely to report negative emotions. Dr. Fauci is encouraged by the findings.
So this is just another one of the studies. The most recent one in an African population, which also does not corroborate the suicidal tendency.
Meanwhile, new, cheaper drugs that might replace efavirenz are on the horizon, but come with risks. Research in Botswana linked dolutegravir to neural tube defects in embryos of pregnant women given the drug. As always, further research is needed to confirm whether this is a common complication.
So I think the entire field now is in a bit of a holding pattern as we get more data about dolutegravir and whether it's safe in this population or not. And I think having more reassuring data on the safety of efavirenz in the meantime is helpful.
Seidner's study is published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
Cell phones and even smartphones are now used by millions of Africans, from the poor to the wealthy, in cities and tiny villages. In South Africa, mobiles and social media connect so many people that an organization is using the technology to advance human rights. Amdala.mobi is a phone-based platform that links people around issues such as crime. It builds resources, drives campaigns, and spreads information. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports about how technology is working for South Africans.
Workers protest against what they call the dumping of cheap chicken from Europe onto the South African market. They say the imports are destroying the country's poultry industry, resulting in the loss of thousands of jobs. This is just one of the many issues that Amandla.mobi has raised voices against, using the communication made possible by cell phones.
Yes, thank you so much. No problem. Okay, bye.
In 2012, the police were advancing on the informal settlement where Koketso Mueti lived to evict her and other residents. But the authorities hadn't bargained on her fighting back using her smartphone.
Suddenly I had internet access, so started a blog as well, started writing about what was happening. I could deploy bulk SMSs to tell neighboring communities to shut down their roads when we were protesting so that police couldn't reach us. It was just this one device that enabled a much bigger world.
Using her phone, Mueti turned public opinion against the evictions. The state bowed and didn't remove poor people from their homes. The success made Mueti think of using mobile networks to unite people to oppose injustice.
Amandla.mobi is a community of over 128,000 people who are working to turn every cell phone into a democracy-building tool. We do this so that no matter where you live, what language you speak, you are able to take action on issues affecting your life.
Amandla is a term that means power to the people. Mueti says her movement tries to empower the powerless with a focus on a particular segment of the population.
Black women from low-income communities disproportionately bear the brunt of any injustice in this country.
Schoolgirls laugh in a classroom as one of their fellow pupils demonstrates how she uses a pair of thick socks as sanitary pads to an Amandla.mobi activist.
So you guys said you use socks, and what else do you use for your period, for your menstruation? Tissue. Yeah. And newspaper.
The girls are so poor that they can't afford sanitary pads and must use other means to prevent embarrassment. Amandla.mobi has launched a campaign for the state to provide free sanitary pads at schools across the country. Ahead of the South African Finance Minister's budget announcement every February, the Treasury asks citizens to suggest what it should spend on.
The call that's made is made only in English. It's accessible only to those who are able to access the internet. So what we did is we took the Treasury form and made it mobile friendly so people could fill in their recommendations, their suggestions.
Like most Amandla.mobi campaigns, the project was run in all 9 official South African languages. Mueti says her organization has made enemies.
The most vile encounters that we've had have been particularly with corporates and with the racists, right?
She says she's lost count of how many times she's been threatened, especially by big companies, after they've mistreated workers.
Corporates in particular know that they have much more resources than an organization like ours. So for them to even suggest just lawsuits and things like that, there's an assumption that you are going to back down because you don't have as much resources.
Moeti has no doubt that Amandla.mobi will have lots of campaigns to mobilize in 2018, with the ruling African National Congress split and rising complaints about deteriorating public services. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nathan Africa. And still to come in the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, the World Cup in Russia has entered the knockout stage with no team from Africa. As most of the world's billions of FIFA World Cup fans know, Colombia beat Senegal 1-0 on Thursday, officially knocking the last of this year's five African qualifying teams out of the competition. VOA's Adam Phillips watched the game at the Senegalese Community Center in New York's bustling Harlem neighborhood. He reports that it was an experience where hope, then disappointment, ran deep, but loyalty to Senegal and Africa ran deepest.
Despite its proud public name, the Senegalese Association in the United States of America might be difficult to spot amid all the African hair braiding salons, fried chicken restaurants, and bubble shops of West 116th Street in Manhattan. But the many bright Senegal flags festooned outside the door shows this reporter exactly where the action is. Inside, Bachi Sam is just one of scores of proud Senegalese Americans sitting on folding chairs watching Senegal in green and Colombia in yellow playing their hearts out on a huge television screen.
So emotional right now. I can't control myself right now.
Why does it matter to you so much?
Well, this is a FIFA World Cup and it is happening every 4 years. Right? So we need to show the world that we can do soccer.
Maybe you'll win the whole cup.
Oh my God, that would be great. And that's what we ask for.
Dr. Alok Patel is one of the few fans here wearing a necktie. Patel has just come from work at a nearby children's hospital.
Patel's an Indian name, right?
It's an Indian name, but I'm here today. My dad grew up in East Africa. I've always loved the way African people come together, the chanting, the energy, the excitement. And the one amazing thing about New York City is that this is one of the only places I know of in the entire world where you can go to a different bar and you can actually watch with people from that country. And it really gets you in the spirit. Where else in the world can I go to the Senegalese Association and actually watch a Senegal game?
Patel wants to see diversity in the upcoming knockout rounds as well.
And I really, really want an African country going there. All Senegal has to do is draw. And they can advance. And so there's a lot hinging on this game. And it's really cool because if Senegal advances the next game, this place is going to be even rowdier.
Idrissa Seck from Dakar wholeheartedly agrees.
Right now, I'm looking for a win. Win, 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 win.
What makes it so exciting for you?
Man, we grew up in a soccer country. We grew up watching our dads, uncles playing soccer. We grew up seeing the passion that our family have without us even knowing. We just wake up one day, we have this love, this huge love in our heart for soccer. We don't call it even soccer, it's football.
What's it like watching it from so far away? Here you are in the U.S., I mean, so many miles away, but still you feel like you're at home, huh?
Yeah, yeah, like in Harlem right here, we're in Little Senegal, so we're not far away from home.
with the red, green, and gold colors of Senegal's flag artfully folded into his West African-style headdress. It's clear where Kunte Kinte's allegiances and passions lie.
It's just the pride I have for my country. We really, really love our country, so we're just here for the country. And not only representing Senegal, but also representing the whole continent. It's all about Africa right now. Because Africa had five teams that was playing in this competition. Four of them already went home. They going home if they not home already. So Africa have only one hope left, which is Senegal. So that's why it's Africa, Africa, Africa.
And Kinte says there's another reason as well.
Because to be honest with you, Africa never really go that far in the World Cup. Never made it to the semifinals. We've been to the quarterfinals, but never made it to the semifinals. And why not take the cup to Africa? The World Cup been to Europe with England, Germany also. It's African time now. It's the motherland, like we say.
Joy suffuses the room when Senegal steals the ball from Colombia right near the opponent's goal, then loses the ball at lightning speed when their pass is intercepted. And Abraham Roerig, an 18-year-old American boy who is here with his mother and a buddy, is riding that roller coaster with everyone else. He says he's also for Africa for the duration.
My favorite team is Ghana, but they didn't qualify this time around. So I love Senegal. Also Nigeria. My godfather is Nigerian. I also have a close friend who spent a year abroad in Dakar in Senegal. So I'm a big fan.
What should we be watching for in this game?
I don't know. Senegal seems to be really fast teams. They seem to score on the fast breaks. Though Colombia is also very good. James Rodriguez, he's a great striker. So yeah.
Senegal also has its superstars. One of the few women here names him.
Mane, Sadio Mane. He have to play hard today. Yeah.
As if on cue, Mane becomes the absolute focus of play. Kadeem Hanna explains.
What happened was Mane had the ball to score, and he got inside the penalty box and was getting ready to strike a goal. And then, like, the defense from Colombia just, like, took him out. No, the ref called a penalty, but of course they wanted us to go and look at the instant replay, and then they said no penalty.
How did that make you feel?
Very mad at this point right now, but you know what? I still believe in Senegal, and we're going to win today, inshallah.
Inshallah.
At halftime, there is still no score. This man gets up to stretch.
We're hanging there. We're good. A little bit stressful.
When the game begins again, the spirit of the fans seem to sag, then rally. Soon, it seems luck is on Senegal's side. Abdou Wasse explains.
Well, Colombia was going to score. Then the defender kicked the ball out.
How does that make you feel?
Great.
What do you think of this game so far?
It's a tough game.
The tie turns once again.
Colombia just scored.
Oh, it did? That's terrible.
Well, let's see what's going to happen. They still have like 20 more minutes to play. It's not over yet.
So the score now is 1-0.
Right.
Good luck to you.
Thanks.
Nearby, Salif Niasse is less optimistic.
I don't know what to think, man. It's crazy right now. It's looking like we need a miracle right now.
Sadly for Senegal, no miracle arrives, and 1-0 remains the final score, allowing Colombia to advance to the knockout phase and forcing Senegal to drop out. This 7-year-old boy expressed his feelings bluntly.
I feel very sad because I'm Senegalese and I wish Senegal win or there was a tie, but they lost. Making me feel sad, angry, and it makes me want to punch the TV right in the face.
In contrast, Papa Ibrahima Sow, president of the Senegalese Association, took a more philosophical view.
Yeah, that's the rule of the game. You know, it's sport. You can win, you can lose. We were very, very hopeful, but unfortunately we lost. The only thing is we have to continue building on what we have already. The challenge for the whole nation should be to be back at the next World Cup. We'll see.
Viva.
Viva.
And viva FIFA. Now it's on to the knockout rounds. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is VOA's Adam Phillips reporting from the little Senegal neighborhood in Harlem, New York.
And now it's time for our Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
It's Die Hard Beat.
Mamacita, te amo. Love the way that you run it always for me. Señorita, te amo. Love the way that the booty rotates for me. Puede que seas mi amiga. Girl, you know that I love you. Oh, oh, oh. Anything that you want me to, can I go do for you? Because when I tell it, I know I go give you the love and show you one more. If the money you want, baby, carry it on. Love me, touch me, kiss me, baby, don't go, don't go. Te amo. Girl, you know I could die for you. Angelina, te amo. I feel killing you bag for you. Baby, please don't go. Puede que seas mi amiga. Girl, I just won't be a friend. Y a vos mi na cupenda.
Sina cha kusema na kupenda. Sina gapa. faranga na shuka kupanda ila na kupenda mimi kwa koni mjinga sinaga ujanja wache wanofonda kama chumba. Matusi matu, wana kunyanyasa, wana kutukana, jitoe. Usiwe mchonga vinyago, tanifirisi. Mwisho wa siku tukigombana ikawa hadithi. Weki tumbo mbele mbele kwa kuku na chipsi. Usiye acha hata mifupa utakuwa fisi. Kama chumba midalali, penzi letu.
Your smile, you tell me, could you, yeah. sad. You tell me goody, goody, yeah. Oh, baby.
Just wanna let them know my feet are muted. Oh, you're my human. It's your come and go. Whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Another day, another goal. Another day to be a mighty warrior.
Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
I fear no evil.
And that was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightland Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightland Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Said Hamdun, and our engineer for tonight, Justin Twites, we thank you for joining us tonight, and I hope you join us tomorrow Sunday. I'm Douglas Impoga.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past 5 years, the Feed the Future Nigeria Livelihoods Project has helped pull some of the most vulnerable families in Nigeria out of poverty. This U.S. government foreign assistance program has helped Nigerians improve agricultural production, income generation, nutrition, and sanitation. The $22.6 million program in Nigeria began in 2013 and concluded just last month. Administered by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, and implemented by Catholic Relief Services, the program initially helped 42,000 poor households in Abuja, Nigeria's capital, Kebbi and Sokoto states, to increase agricultural production, diversify incomes, and improve nutrition. It also provided livelihoods planning skills, adult literacy and numeracy instruction, and cash transfers to the most vulnerable households. In 2017, the program expanded to Adamawa, Borno, and Yobe states, reaching 10,000 more households. This project took a holistic approach to agriculture, to livelihoods, and to social development, said USAID Mission Director Stephen Hagen. It addressed the needs of the extreme poor by improving incomes and reducing vulnerabilities, and in this way serving as a model for efforts to build resilience in rural Nigeria. The USAID program introduced new technology, improving agricultural production and access to input markets such as quality seeds for smallholder farmers. As a result, crop yields doubled for more than 33,000 farmers. The program also helped farmers to reduce post-harvest losses. The activity engaged poor households in the rural economy by providing business skills and financial literacy support, vocational trainings and lending schemes, and safe spaces for adolescent girls. Additionally, more than 2,000 community workers were trained to deliver over 1.5 million counseling and group sessions on nutrition that led to a 22% drop in stunting, 10% drop in wasting, and 53% increase in exclusive breastfeeding rates in targeted locations. A cash transfer component alone helped lift 2,740 households out of poverty. State and local governments have shown positive support towards sustaining the gains from the program. The U.S. is proud to work with its partner Nigeria to improve the lives of the Nigerian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.